session number 25184, Reel 3.
Edward Palfrey, Reel 3. You were saying that you finished your training at HMS St George in February of 1941, and that you were sent to your depot at Devonport. How long were you there for?
I was at Devonport until May the 7th. The other boys who went to Devonport with me all went on draft to different ships during that period, but the reason I was there as long as I was is because my parents, rightly or wrongly, thought it would be a good idea if I would serve in the same ship as my older brother. This required Admiralty permission. And the Admiralty, before they would grant such a request, had to get in writing the approval of both parents for this to happen. So, I didn't actually leave the camp at Plymouth. I was stationed at Glenoak Camp, which was an outlying establishment from the main barracks. It was about 5 miles from the centre of Plymouth. And I was there during the period of the Plymouth Blitz. And I didn't get permission to go and join the Norfolk until the 7th of May. But during the time that I was at Plymouth, at Glenoak Camp, throughout the whole period, the boys that were there waiting drafts to ships were all sent into Plymouth on various jobs connected with the Blitz. Some days we would be street clearing, and I remember in West George Street in Plymouth, it was full of rubble, etc., and we spent hours and hours and hours shifting that. For much of the other time, we were moving effects and furniture from bombed-out houses in Plymouth and taking it to various places. Mainly, we were taking it to the home park, Plymouth Argyle's football ground, and placing the effects and furniture and all that in different piles in the stand. Another job that we did do one Saturday was we went to Plimstock. The Royal Air Force had supplied, I'm not sure how many, but I think it was 80 lorries from somewhere up in Bedfordshire to Plymouth to assist in the helping the civilian population during the Blitz. And it was on these lorries which we used to man, four boys at a time to these lorries, moving the furniture, as I said. But on one Saturday, out of the blue, we were told we were going in lorries to Plimstock, and we had to take with us shovels and so forth. And when we got there, we discovered that a German plane had dropped 8 or 9 bombs in a row. And the nearest one was very close to the church. Behind the church, there was an orchard. And it was in this orchard that I was assigned. And these bomb holes, you could see the about so big they were. And they weren't going just straight down, they were going in at an angle into the soil. And they must have gone very, very deep, because we spent all the morning shifting earth from a large area around them so that the bomb squad would be able to come and defuse them. Well, we got there, I think, about 8:30 in the morning. And we worked tirelessly shifting this earth, wondering if these bombs would go off. Fortunately, they didn't. But we didn't seem to get very far down, because all the time that we were there, it was raining. And it was an absolute quagmire, a huge round sort of hole around this. And we were trying to shift the earth out of it. Well, this was a Saturday, and we were supposed to have had our lunch brought out for us from the barracks at HMS Drake. I can't remember what time it was supposed to arrive. I suppose half past 12 or 1 o'clock. But we were still there at half past 2, soaking wet, feeling thoroughly miserable, and having had nothing to eat. And the officer in charge said, right, we're going to go back to Glen Holt. So we all got on the lorries and went back to Glen Holt. We never saw the place after that, I was pleased to say. But I've often wanted to go back to Plimstock and see what it's like now. But my son, who lives near there, says, you would never recognise anything like that. He said, it's a concrete jungle now. It wouldn't be worth you going to see. But I wanted to go back, and I wanted to see if perhaps there was a brass plaque or something in the church to recording the event. That was the thing I remember most about my visit to Glen Holt on that occasion. But we spent all the time until I went to join the Norfolk doing jobs like that. And we were in a camp adjacent to a small aerodrome at Roeborough, which was used by fighters, I think. And when we weren't out during the day doing things in Plymouth, we were employed on sentry duty and sometimes on patrols in the woods, because it was rumoured, and it was only a rumour, that there may be agents in the woods lighting magnesium flares to show the German planes the way in, but we never found anyone. I remember that being sentry on the gate with a loaded rifle. It wasn't very old. And I remember having to say, if anybody approached, one had to say, halt, who goes there? And advance and be recognised, and expressions such as that. I wonder how they do it today.
You must have been about 17 at this stage.
I was 16 then. I was 16 when I joined the Norfolk. I was 17 in August 41, and I'd been on board the Norfolk a few months then.
So you were 16 when you joined the Norfolk on the 7th of May?
I was
16 when you
joined. Yes, I was 16, yes.
Excuse me, on the 7th of May, yeah, 1941.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your first impressions of joining what was your first ship?
Yes, well, it wasn't a happy experience going to join the first ship, really. I was looking forward to going, meeting my brother and finding out what the Navy was all about, of course. But going from Plymouth, we were sent to Thurso, which is the stepping off place, as it were, for Scapa Flow. When we got to Thurso, we loaded all our kit bags from the train onto the little ship going across to Scapa. I remember it was called the St. Ninian. Everybody got their kit on board, and you can imagine what it was like. The train was full of sailors, and suddenly the message was broadcast that all ratings joining HMS Norfolk removed their kit back onto the train. The ship wasn't at Scapa Flow. We would be told where it was. So we'd get on the train, and we had to go down to Rosyth, having had about 2 days on the train already. We went to Rosyth, and that's where we joined the Norfolk. She had been in for a refit or something at Rosyth, and she was then ready for sea. So I joined the ship, completely lost, didn't know where I was, didn't know one end from the other, didn't know one deck from the other. didn't know where my mess was, didn't know where my locker was, didn't know where the bathroom was. And to say that I was in a state of confusion is a mild understatement. But one soon got the idea. And it didn't take me too long to settle down, really. The thing I remember most about the first day or two was that I think it was the day after I joined, we went out and anchored near the Firth of Forth Bridge. And I remember it was bitterly cold, and there was water or something flying off the bridge, coming from somewhere. And I was sent out to the forecastle with a set of flags to indicate to the bridge the state of the anchor. I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue what to do. But it was good fun. And it was rather funny because that was the only time I was ever employed on that job on that ship. Did it once. But then we went from Rosyth. I don't think we were there more than a couple of days. Then we went up to Scapa Flow. And there we spent 2 or 3 days, I suppose, doing gunnery practice, going out of Scapa Flow to the sea and firing at a target and so on. And the next thing was we were sent on to the Denmark Strait Patrol, which was between Iceland and Greenland.
What was your job on board?
My job was, as soon as I joined the ship, I spent quite a lot of time on the flag deck, as it was called. That's where all the flags get hoisted from flags all in lockers there. But my particular job was, I was assigned as the flag lieutenant's messenger. The flag lieutenant was a very nice man. He was Lieutenant the Viscount David Kilburn. He was a very pleasant man to work for, and I was just his messenger, or more commonly known as the runner. But during the day, I was employed on the signal deck, keeping a lookout for other ships, submarines, aircraft, anything like that, and exchanging signals with other ships or passing vessels and so on. But my specific job was, if there was anything required to be delivered to the flag lieutenant, it was my job to take it from the signal office to wherever he was. He was usually on the bridge anyway. And then, more often than not, he'd give me whatever it was. I'd give it to him in a sealed envelope, and he'd give it back for me to put in his cabin, which was on the deck below. But the one thing about I soon learned was that reading signals in a barracks, where you get just the occasional noise, is one thing. But reading and transmitting signals when everything is happening on a ship is entirely another ballgame. I mean, guns could be firing, aeroplanes could be flying close nearby, other ships can be shooting, all sorts of things can be happening, but signals are based, the communication system is based upon reliability, security, and speed. Whatever you send, it's got to get the other end correctly. And likewise, if you're receiving something, you're expected to get it word perfect. From a security angle, you have to remember that in wartime, flashing lights are very limited in scope. One has a tiny light on a pair of binoculars. You have to train the binoculars on the bridge of the ship you're signaling to. And he replies to you with a similar light. And it's totally different than reading signals from a lamp on shore. And of course, this is one of the things that you learn as a result of experience. Another thing I learned too is that one is usually given a job as lookout on the windy side or the weather side. being the junior boy, that's where you go. You go where you're sent. And sometimes, I mean, if there's only one ship with you, you're given the side where there's no ship. All you've got is seagulls and water, and seagulls and water to look at. And all you're doing is looking out to see if anything appears. Life can be very boring under those conditions, but when you're involved with the fleet or anything, it's not boring at all. You don't have time to get bored.
Can you go into a bit more detail about the system of sending and receiving signals?
Yes. It depends, of course, where the ships are. If the ship is in Scapa Flow at a large anchorage with a lot of ships present, the flagship would send out semaphore, perhaps in three directions, to all the ships around the harbour. They put the signal up saying, I have a general semaphore message for all ships. And every ship then answers. And when the flagship sees that everyone is answering, these operators who are standing in a conspicuous position, usually with the skyline as a background, they start signalling. Now, semaphore, it's normally made facing the person you're signalling to, and it's therefore normally read forwards, as it were. But sometimes the person who is standing up there signalling to you is in fact signalling to somebody that way, he's signalling to you it this way. So you've got to read it backwards. That is not quite so easy. Well, you get used to it, but it's not quite so easy. But it depends on which direction he shows the sign. If he shows the sign like that, it means he's signalling in that direction. And if you happen to be there, you know that you've got to read it the other way around. Not so easy. But then flashing light is quite... it's all right by day. You use a 10-inch signalling projector. And I've known occasions when I've gone on duty at 8 o'clock in the morning and I've been on the 10-inch signal projector continuously, until I've been relieved at 12:30, doing nothing but sending or receiving messages. In Iceland particularly was a place such as that, because there were always a number of ships in Iceland. Quite a few Americans would be there, and they never stop signaling. They're always chattering. They're encouraged to chatter, I think, between themselves. We're not encouraged to do that. We do it, but we're not encouraged to do it.
How do you get the signals that you send? What was the chain of command, as it were? How did you receive the message that you were supposed to send?
It would be received by the operators. Written, it's usually written in duplicate, sometimes in triplicate. It's always written in pencil. It's not always easy to do that, incidentally, if it's raining, because the pad gets wet and all that. But as soon as the signals are received, one copy normally, it would be sent to the bridge for the captain and the officer, duty officer on the bridge, officer of the watch to see. The other copy would go into the signal office, and from there it would be distributed around the ship as necessary. It used to be a tedious business, because everything was normally, other than the bridge, anyone else who got it would normally get a typed copy. And they have other means of doing it now. But in those days it was a lengthy way of doing it. It was a big time lapse between the time that some signals were received and until they got distributed to the rest of the ship.
How about sending messages? How did you get the messages?
Well, the message would come, the originating officer, there is a system of signals, it's changed now, but the originator of the signal writes the signal on a pad, and then he has to get it released by someone higher up. Then it goes to the signal office, the main signal office. From there, if it's to go by wireless, they give it to the telegraphers to transmit, and if it's to go by visual signals, they send it in a pneumatic tube to the signal deck, and from there it gets transmitted, and the time of dispatch and so forth is appended. One copy is kept on the signal log there, and the other copy goes back to the signal office so that they know it's been transmitted.
Were visual signals ever sent in code?
The signals that went by flags were normally from a signal book. They weren't sent in encrypted code as such, but they were groups of flags which had certain meanings, you see. And it was called the Fleet Code, but there was no real security attached to it. But the real codes that we used to use, the three-letter Fleet Code, as it was known, it was in use at the time when I first went to sea, that had no security value at all. If the Germans intercepted it, they seemed to know what we were doing. It was later in the war that things got a bit encrypting of signals and so forth. That became one of my specialities later, because I used to do a lot of teaching that, and I had several jobs where I did that on other ships and establishments.
You were obviously in the signaling branch of the ship. Was that separate from the telegraphy branch, or part of the same?
It was part of the communication branch, but we used to mess separately. The communicators' mess, for example, on board HMS Norfolk, was right forward. It was the most forward mess of all, and it was either side of the A turret, the main turret, forward. The telegraphers were on the port side, and the signalmen were on the starboard side. We messed in the same mess deck, but they messed sort of separately to us. And their work was completely different to ours in those days. These days, some of it is combined.
Could you explain the structure of the communications branch?
Well, yes, the visual signal side, of which I was a member, would perhaps, like on board the Norfolk, I think we had about 17. There was a chief yeoman of signals, four yeoman of signals, which were petty officers, perhaps four leading signalmen, or perhaps only three, and the rest would be made up of signalmen or ordinary signalmen, and they may have one or two boys. When I joined the Norfolk, I was the only signal boy. Soon later, there was another one or two joined. But on the other side, they were more numerous. They would have a chief radio supervisor, or chief PO telegrapher, as he was in those days, and they'd have perhaps four petty officers and four leading telegraphers, but they'd have rather more junior people than we used to have, because they used to have a lot more circuits to man, you see, by wireless.
What about officers in the communications part?
Well, normally on a cruiser like the Norfolk, we had a lieutenant commander and perhaps a warrant officer. And in more modern ships, it's usually a lieutenant commander, what they call a senior communication officer. Sometimes it's just a lieutenant, but they used to be specialists. I'm not so sure that they are specialists now. They changed things some years ago, I think.
Did you mess with the other signalmen, even though you were a boy?
No. As a boy signalman, I messed in the boys' mess deck, which was below the main deck, as it were. It was on the same level as the communicator's mess, but it was in the next compartment. And that was a mess purely for boys. The corner of the mess was a small sort of cubicle area where there were four boys' instructors lived, and they were there, as it were, day and night. and they'd keep an eye on the boys, make sure that they were turned in at 9 o'clock or whatever time, I think it was 9 o'clock, and make sure that they were all getting fed and all that kind of thing. And there was, they didn't mind hilarity, but they didn't have too much skylarking and that sort of thing. They kept an eye on their general sort of behaviour. And I didn't particularly like the boys' mess deck very much, because there were one or two seamen boys who thought that I should do as they said, which didn't go down too well. And the system in those days for messing was that the chefs, the cooks in the galley, would cook the meal, and the meal would be brought down in trays and served out. But before they cooked the meal, each mess had to peel enough potatoes and put them in a net bag and take them to the galley to be cooked. Well, for whatever reason, it always seemed to be my lot to peel the potatoes. But being a signal boy and not having anything to do with the others at work, they didn't understand that I wasn't able to spend my time peeling spuds in the mess. I was required on the signal deck to work. Anyway, we managed to get over that difficulty ultimately, but it did take a while. But the boys' mess deck was mostly seamen boys. There were one or two sparkers, I think, and there was myself. But fortunately, I escaped from that zone of messing in a relatively short time, because I qualified in an advanced an examination for accelerated advancement, so that instead of becoming an ordinary seaman at 18, I became an ordinary signalman at 17 and a half. So I didn't spend too long in the boys' mess, only from May 41 until February 42.
Going back to your first job on the Norfolk, you were the runner for the flag lieutenant.
Mm.
Talked a little bit about what that job involved. Can you tell
me? Well, it was mainly the question of attending on the flag lieutenant when he needed somebody to attend on him to take messages here or there. The flag lieutenant really is the admiral's particular signal officer attached to him. Well, if the admiral wanted this or that or the other thing, wanted to send a signal, and the flag lieutenant wanted it to go to the signal office, he would call me up and I'd take it. That was what it amounted to. And vice versa, if there was something from the cipher office or from the main signal office that had to go to the flag lieutenant, I would be summoned and I would take it to him. But, it was quite a pleasant job, but that was extraneous sort of duty, really. But what I was normally doing was on the flag deck, keeping a lookout for other ships, etc., hoisting flag signals, making semaphore, sending or receiving messages by light and all that. It's quite a busy job, actually. It was very interesting. And of course, signalmen are always looked upon by the rest of the crew as being the people who are well informed. Because in the majority of cases, except where operational orders have been issued prior to a trip or something like that, or prior to an operation, they're issued through secure channels. They don't come to us. But anything that comes by signals, we get to see it first. We get to see it before the captain does. But we're not expected to talk about it. And we don't. But I used to get buttonholed by it whenever I took anything to the flag lieutenant. I mean, it involved all sorts of signals. Some were signals sealed in envelopes, and there would be reports about this or that. Reports, we used to get information, intelligence reports and all that, about which German ship is doing what. Well, that would have been of intense interest to our ship's crew. Well, they never got to find out of it through me, but the signalman used to do everything to get me to show them this and show them that. I was better informed than they were, and I hadn't been on board very long.